Welcome to Indie Game Business, where you'll learn to navigate the industry with ease. This show is produced by the Powell Group, the leading business consulting firm in the gaming industry. Visit us online at indiegame.business to learn about our online digital events. We have some amazing sessions with people in the gaming industry, and you can participate for free and purchase inexpensive passes to our industry-leading business-to-business system. Now, here we go, Indie Game Business.
Oh, thank you.
What's up, everybody? My name is Indy, and the gentleman next to me is Jay Powell from Powell Group Consulting, and welcome to Indie Game Business. Today, we've got Justin Barenbaum from Exola, and the title of this is How to Get Funding, Investments, and Publishing Your Indie Game. All the things that everybody wants to know right now. So pay attention. Pay close attention.
And welcome, Justin, make sure you unmute in Discord.
Oh, I need to unmute in Discord, too.
So, do we want to, this is like, what, your fifth time on the show or something? So,
it's been a while, though. I think the last time we did it was, during the pandemic. It's been a couple years, I think. I've been off running and hiding around the world trying to talk to indies all over the world. So, I've let you talk to bigger, better, smarter folks. So, somehow I ended up back on the show.
Well, that's because, you know, this always rises to the same level. So, you and I, the same... Surround yourself with other people that know a lot more, and that's what we do. So we can probably fast forward through the tell us how you got into the industry thing, because we've done that multiple times. Walk us through what you've been doing for the last couple of years at Exola, your role there, and all the wonderful stuff that you do for indies.
Well, so I will say this, and I have to be, you know, pretty honest. I am super lucky in the role that I have. I actually get paid to travel around the world and be an evangelist for indie games, not necessarily for Exola. That's a byproduct. My focus really has been for the last number of years is trying to educate folks on, I won't say what to pitch, but how to pitch, what investors are looking for, how to present information to them in a quick, easy process. How to set yourself up for success, how to build a business. A lot of the stuff they don't teach you anywhere or in school, and a lot of stuff that most developers just aren't good at, right? I can't make a game, but I know the business really well. I think a lot of people don't know the business. Unfortunately, one of the byproducts of being able to self-publish and digital distribution is that now devs need to know the business almost as well as investors or publishers, just to be able to either launch their own game or get a deal. So I'm lucky that I spent a lot of time flying around the world, talking to folks, meeting with governments to evangelize our industry, meeting with devs to talk about their problems, issues, making friends all over the world, talking about how do we help more indie games get made. I think that's where all the creativity is. So like I said, I'm super lucky. Exola pays me to just travel around and try to help more great games get made. So that's kind of my main role. We're not that altruistic. We always want those indies to eventually use Exola if they can and will. But I'm not going to hide the elephant in the room, right? Like we are a corporation trying to make money. But that's it. You know, I just got back from a rather lengthy trip. I was in 8 plane flights, 7 hotels, 5 countries, 4 trade shows in 4 weeks.
Crap, dude.
Just got back from, I don't blame anybody but myself. I'm also old, so when I travel to Asia, it's much easier to stay there for a long time versus go and come back. I don't know if anybody's had that jet lag, but it's not nice, at least for me. It's about a 2-day penalty. I went over, got to go to Indonesia, got to go to Malaysia. I was in Singapore, and then I was down at the first ever South by Southwest in Sydney, mostly focused on meeting with developers and indie developers. Got to spend some time with folks who run the events, got to spend time with the government, and in particular in Indonesia, got the opportunity to meet with a couple ministers and talk about some really cool stuff about how transforming their economy from a resource-based economy to a digital-based economy can actually help preserve the environment, because it's a huge issue over there. Had a great like half-day meeting on a private island. Somehow I finagled my way onto the island. And we just sat around and talked about how do we help the economy move over to be more sustainable by using games, which is one of those conversations, if you'd asked me 30 years ago, I would have never imagined having.
Is it weird? Because I've been in these conversations with not just government types, but like the high up government types, the directors of finance, and it's like not a world that we typically run in. Is it still a little bit unusual when all these people show up in suits and they don't necessarily understand everything that we do, that we're like, oh yeah, we're the cool kids in the room?
Well, I can't say I've ever been called the cool kid, except maybe when I was a DJ 35 years ago. But even then I wasn't that cool. The thing I think it's interesting is that now that games have been so much more widely accepted, and we can go back to, you know, ancient times when you and I started in the industry and there was a fight for games even to exist. We got, you know, labeled as porn by the government. They tried to ban us, all kinds of stuff. It's very interesting. And I think the pandemic has done a lot, especially in emerging markets, for making gaming okay, especially in places in Southeast Asia, Indonesian, maybe not so much, but some of these countries, India in particular, where, you know, before, if you were in gaming, you were kind of an outcast. You were looked at as, you know, somebody who couldn't make it in the real world. And the pandemic changed a lot of that. So it's interesting meeting with a lot of these government types. Every country is very different. Indonesia was really interesting because they weren't all in suits. They were dressed nicely, but they weren't all in suits. They were pretty laid back. We had a very casual kind of open conversation. They were super interested in hearing things. I think they all realized just how much money gaming can bring, not just money, but jobs, educational opportunities, and the opportunity to keep their best and brightest in the country. I think that's one of the things a lot of these emerging markets are really interested in, because their best and brightest are in a hurry to leave the country and go where the opportunities are. So they're really interested in how do they create a ecosystem where those people will actually stay, create jobs, create opportunities for other bright people, and grow these homegrown institutions that become huge. You know, I think Canada is the perfect model for what happened with gaming over the last 20 or 30 years in terms of it went from nothing to being, you know, almost dominant. What the UK has done reemergence wise, Australia started having their government commit. I think you've seen a lot of these places realize just how important gaming can be to driving the digital ecosystem and all the technology that comes out of games or wants to go into games. We're having the conversation before we jumped on about all these technology companies that want into gaming. Well, those companies exist all over the world. And so if you now have gaming companies all over the world, more of them are jumping in. So it's interesting to see how much the government's paying attention now compared to even 10, 15 years ago.
It's not just though. I mean, it's countries all over the world. We see it when we go even to, you know, Europe. In some of the shows that we were at last year, it's not uncommon at all to get that comment from the politicians that we didn't realize how much money was in this, how much, you know, opportunity was here. Because, like you said, in many cases, we're still looked at as, you know, well, that's a kid's thing and it's not real and grownups don't work in that space. But like you said, with the pandemic and every other industry starts faltering and, you know, us and liquor are blowing up through the roof. That's so in North Carolina.
I'm just going to say correlation is not causation. So we can't.
No, it's not, but it ain't far off. In North Carolina. So our liquor stores are actually owned by the government. So you can't go into like a grocery store and get a bottle of Jack Daniels. Coincidentally, when they started declaring, you know, which business could stay open because they were emergency or mandatory or whatever the word they use for it, all the liquor stores made the list. So you might not have been able to get cereal or something, you know, during the lockdown here in North Carolina, but you could go get you a fifth of gin. I mean, that's perfectly essential That was the word they used.
I'm going to call it priorities.
It was an essential business. All right. So since we're talking about a lot of the growth that we've seen in the industry, we're also over the last 6 months, and especially since the notorious Embracer speech, we're seeing a bit of the hangover and the backlash from all that growth and explosion and all that sort of stuff.
We are. What
is the current state of investment in the industry?
Well, I don't think it's going to come to a surprise to anybody who's listening or comes later. I mean, it's slow. It's slowed dramatically. I think it's going to stay slow. If I pull out my crystal ball, it's going to stay slow for another 6 to 8 months minimum. I think you'll start seeing a lot of talking, a lot more talking going on in February at events like DICE and, of course, GDC. I feel like almost everybody now is still kind of looking, but it feels like people are literally shutting down, kind of accepting new stuff for the rest of the year already, and we're not even in November. I think things started slowing down at the beginning of the year. Anybody who was out pitching or looking for funding realized that. There's a couple big side effects, and I think sometimes people don't delve in deep enough. One is that because of the boom in 2020 and the carryover into 2021, a lot of new games got signed by a lot of publishers and investors. Sometimes a lot of that was done without the proper due diligence, because you couldn't meet with people in person because everybody was desperate. The market was growing so fast. Everybody needed to make sure there was enough content. I think a lot of people overbought content, just like people overhired. I'm not making excuses for all the ridiculous layoffs and everything going on in the industry right now. That's not the excuse, but I think it's definitely been a correction that people aren't talking about as much as maybe they should. I think that you're also seeing a backlash from a lot of really bad investments. You saw a lot of investors jump into blockchain, crypto, Web3, buzzword of the week investments. Most of those have not panned out and have done pretty poorly. And so those investors are now licking their wounds. One of the other things people don't talk about, I don't know if people really understand how like big VCs work, but they have a bunch of limited partners. Those limited partners agree to give them money during what's called a capital call. Well, in the past, they would do a capital call and all the investors would send in the money and then the funds would go invest it. Now, because of everything that's going on, a lot of times when those investors get those capital calls, they may still legally be required to send in that money, but they're questioning the investments. They're now second guessing the VCs a little bit, which is actually even slowing down the process more. The VCs are even more cautious about what they even bring to their investors because they obviously don't want to be questioned. So everything's just ground to a halt. You know, deals that would normally take 1 to 3 months or 3 to 9 months or even longer. I think that's going to continue. There's still a few folks out there signing games, but unfortunately, it's going to be tough until mid next year when I think everybody looks at their slates and go, okay, we don't have anything for maybe 2025 and 26. But most people I know that I talk to, they still have full slates for 24. So they're not necessarily looking for stuff shipping in the next 12 months because they've still got stuff they signed from a year or two ago. I think the panic will set in the second half of last year, and I've seen it before. I saw it in 2014, 2015. I saw it in 2008, saw it in 2000, that everybody goes into hibernation, and all of a sudden, oh, God, we've got no title shipping in the second half of 2026, and there's a panic. I think in the meantime, developers are going to be forced to get really creative. They're going to have to get better at self-publishing, self-promoting, self-marketing. They're going to get better at planning and better at running businesses than they ever have been if they want to survive. It's the nature of things. What, how many? 11, 12,000 games on Steam this year. I forget the exact percentage. Simon Careless from Game Discover doesn't that actually make any more than $1,000. And that's not getting any better. So I think some of it's just sheer volume.
I agree with you 100%. I will say that we're still seeing a decent amount of funding from investors and publishers right now. It's obviously not where it was, but it's not a complete drought.
But no, not completely, but it's slowed down significantly.
But you brought up an excellent point, and I want to dive into this a little bit because it frustrates the shit out of me. And you're right. Everybody's got stuff, not everybody, but a large percentage of the companies have stuff planned through 2024, and they're going to hit Q3 next year. And then exactly like you said, they're going to go, oh shit, we don't have anything for 2025 or 2026. And it's going to become chaos again. you and I've been doing this for 20 some years. The industry's been around for 40. Why can't people plan ahead? I mean, to this day, they can't plan ahead.
I think there's a couple things that are going on, right? It's planning. Some of it is classic, I call it corporate sphincter tightening, corporate panic, corporate missteps. And then also, let's be clear, some of it's just pure corporate overspending, right? You know, a lot of these companies, publishers, investors overspent on stuff in 2021 in particular, in the rush to get a bunch more content because of the success, you know, the pandemic and all. But when people overspend, eventually you pay for it. I think, you know, people made a lot of bad investments. People overpaid for those investments. And I'm not necessarily blaming indies. I think indies are the unfortunate side effect of people investing too much in big projects that weren't going to succeed. And I don't know how much we want to get into, you know, multiples and valuations of studios. You know, we saw more studios get bought in, I think, 2020, 2021 than maybe the previous 5-10 years combined. And I think that those studios that got bought, a lot of them times they got bought for way too much money, way more than they should have, because the valuations were ridiculous. You know, they were getting 30, 40X on future revenues. And I mean, just some numbers. When I remember talking to a studio and trying to actually pitch them for a publishing deal, and they were getting a deal for equity that was, I mean, I literally just told them to take it. Like, sometimes, you know, dumb money is dumb money. And if somebody's going to give you dumb money for something, you take it. But at some point, somebody pays the price for, you know, spending too much dumb money. And I think that's part of it as well. Is I think not just investors overspent, but publishers overspent, both on marketing and signing new games and maybe, you know, taking chances where they shouldn't have. And so the belt tightening is going on. And unfortunately, you know, it's always a pendulum, right? It never seems to sit in the middle. It's not even a little bit in the middle. It always seems to swing to extremes. And I think we've hit that extreme. I think also a lot of people are just aren't sure where the markets are going. And I do think the panic's a little unjustified. It's not like the market's down 20, 30%. What, we were down 3% last year, 4%. And some of that, if you take into, you know, factor the abnormal growth in 20 and 2021, it's really, you know, it's still the compound adjusted growth rate of the industry is still going up. I just think that you know, you had too much money going into too many places where it shouldn't. And now it's going to be tight. And you know, I think, you know, the money doesn't grow on trees unless you're the US government, and then they just seem to print it and just jack up inflation. But, you know, somewhere down the line, you pay for it, right? Like, I don't know about you, but if I spend too much money this month, I'm not going to be able to go out as much next month. And I think that's also what's happened.
Oh, we can't do that debt ceiling shit where we just like decide to give ourselves more credit. Is that not how it works?
I think if you have really good lawyers, you might be able to get away with it.
Oh, already had a couple of good questions coming in. Love this one. Jason on LinkedIn says, do you think Microsoft overspent with Activision?
Oh God, this is, how much trouble do I want to get myself in here?
Look, man, if you get fired, I got openings. We're all good. You can come over here to this side of the table.
I don't think I'll get fired from Mixola. I might burn some bridges later. So look, I think overpay is relative. There is a lot of questions about that deal. I will say this, and no qualms about it. I don't know. Bobby Kotick should also be titled the magician, no matter what you want to call him. Everybody stop talking about all of the harassment stuff and everything else that went on. And everybody for the last year and a half, so all they've been talking about is the acquisition. You know, I don't know what happens to Bobby now. He rides off into the sunset with his $500 million, or he sticks around. I don't know. I think overpay is relative. I actually don't think they did, and here's why. You forget what else comes with the Activision Blizzard. You're thinking about King, which puts Microsoft squarely back in the mobile space, which is somewhere they have not been. Now imagine all of the Microsoft IPs now running through the King machine, and all those games now being pumped out by King and some of the other stuff. I think that strategically there's so much going on. Let's not forget about the Activision catalog, which even they don't realize how many games they have in their catalog. I used to do all the outbound licensing for them, and their catalog is huge. All those games, past, present, future, can now go into the Xbox Game Pass library. All kinds. I actually don't think they overpaid. I will say my initial gut reaction when that amount came through, I thought they significantly overpaid given what had happened to Activision's stock price. But the folks at Microsoft, and especially, you know, Matt and those guys, they're super smart. They took a look at this. They knew the stock price had been hammered because of all the bad news, and that it had been hammered worse than it probably should have been. So I think it was great. Now, do I think some of the concessions they had to give in Europe with the streaming and some other stuff seem a little weird? Sure. I'm more concerned about why our government didn't get involved in the Ticketmaster deal than why the government got involved in the Activision Blizzard. And let's be clear, Sony PlayStation is still bigger and generates more revenue than the combined Microsoft, Activision Blizzard, Bethesda behemoth. So while those concerns are somewhat valid, I'm not as concerned about that. I just want to see more great games coming out of them, and if they, some of their catalog gets revived. So I guess the long answer to the question, do they overpay? I don't think so. You're not going to be able to tell for a while. Depends on the synergies and how they integrate. But I think that deal, just even with just you factor in King and some of the other things, will pay itself off pretty quickly. It's a great question, though.
I agree. I mean, maybe if you sit down and you run a bunch of numbers, it may not look like it's going to add up. But strategy-wise and what it brings to the table for Microsoft, especially on the Game Pass side and all this other stuff, yeah, I think it was extremely well worth it.
I mean, and there's some things they can do with catalog tie-ins. I think there's so many smart people at Microsoft. I think that, you know, I don't really consider Microsoft and Sony necessarily in competition. Like a lot of people think, Microsoft's playing a very different game. With Game Pass and some other stuff, they're playing a slightly different game than PlayStation even. I think Microsoft is actually more focused, their competition being Google and Apple, than it being, you know, maybe even Netflix, than it actually being Sony PlayStation. And so this sets them up much better to compete in that arena. They now have access to the esports stuff from Activision. They have access to a whole bunch of stuff that they wouldn't have had before. I just think it positions them better for the next 20 years than people really realize.
It's interesting. That's a good point, because so for years, early on, it was like the console wars were Sega and Nintendo. And then, you know, over the years, it became Microsoft, PlayStation, Nintendo. But Nintendo's off to the side now. They do their own thing. You can't really put them in that category. And now it looks like Microsoft, because I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. It looks like Microsoft is kind of stepping away and saying, look, we're not trying to be Sony. You know, we're trying to build something else here, and we could, we never will, as much as I would like to get to past the point of X better or Sony better or whatever. But it does look like we're getting away from a head-to-head challenge, because Sony has shown no intention of going this way. I mean, they are, if anything, doubling down on their, we're going to continue to do giant blockbuster games and nothing else. So that's a very good point.
Well, and again, I think we all saw this, especially in the indie game side. We saw what a big push that Sony did with indie games for a long time. You know, we had some friends over there for a long time that were doing some great stuff with indie games, PlayStation, especially around PlayStation 3 and into PlayStation 4. Shout out to Adam Boys, who's over at Iron Galaxy now. I mean, he did some amazing stuff at Sony in pushing indies and driving them forward. And then, you know, he left and a few things changed, and you've got some great people over there now, Christian Svensson and some other folks that are doing stuff for indies. But I feel like they're fighting against the big corporate machine that is so focused on AAA. I think, you know, again, disproportionate amount of the revenue comes from AAA. And I think, you know, so they're focused on AAA. So I think some of that, you've seen that lately, that there's not been as enough support or as much support for indies, where I feel like Microsoft's been much more consistent over the last 10 years. Again, big shout out to Chris Charla, ID at Xbox, and the rest of his team over there. But I feel like Microsoft's been really consistent about their support for indies, the different programs. You know, you can argue the pros and cons of Game Pass and whether or not that's really good for indies, yada, 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 and what models. But the reality is, I feel like, you know, Sony has kind of done a bit of a Matador approach off and on. I think they're trying to get back into indies again. Microsoft's been way more consistent with it. And so I feel like, again, that just different set of strategies. I'm not sure exactly when Microsoft made a decision not to necessarily compete with Sony. I think they did a great job of letting everybody think they're directly competing with Sony for a number of years. But if you look over the last 5-6 years and some of the strategic moves they made with some of the acquisitions, some of the focus on the content, and even, you know, Game Pass, you know, before it was Xbox Live and Xbox Live Gold, whatever, they've been transitioning this way for quite some time.
Yeah, they have. They, all right, so we have like a slew of good questions in here. So all that
we can do a rapid fire. I'll try to keep my answer shorter.
Well, I mean, all the planning that we did 10 minutes ago about we're going to talk about this probably just got thrown out the window.
Which is fine, by the way. This is the way. Like, I love these kind of just freeform AMAs. It's way more fun.
I do too. It's a lot easier too. So Amber on YouTube says, so for a better chance of getting signed with a publisher, should we focus more on a successful Kickstarter for funding to go full time? Will a publisher be more likely to partner then?
Oh, that is a great question. Amber, I'm going to give you a really important word of caution. Kickstarter can be the best thing or the worst thing ever for a game. I will guarantee you if it's done wrong, it will absolutely kill the game. I don't know how many times, and Jay, maybe you can tell me, how many times you've seen a game fail on Kickstarter and then never go on to get funding. One of the first things a publisher does when they get a pitch in, they do a Google search on the name of the game and they will do a Google search on the studio. And the first things that come up are, you know, articles. Almost always the first thing that comes up is if there was a Kickstarter or not and it failed. I will always urge folks to be super cautious with early access and Kickstarter. Most of the successful Kickstarters I know now, those games would have been made already. And they were done more for marketing purposes than they were to get funded. So be very careful about your strategy. Anya Combs, who's over at BackerKit now, who used to be at Kickstarter and run the indie game stuff, look her up. It's A-N-Y-A, then C-O-M-B-S. She has a bunch of great talks on how to do a successful Kickstarter, what it takes to be successful, and all that. And most of it comes down to you need to have the game far enough along where you actually have a great demo. You need to have a whole plan. It becomes a full-time job, both a month before the Kickstarter, during the Kickstarter, and after the Kickstarter. So I'm never saying don't do it, but just realize it's going to be a three-month full-time commitment. And if you don't already have a community built, you better build one first before you start your Kickstarter. You're going to fail pretty quickly. So make sure that you've done all of the homework. Anya is way smarter at this stuff than I am. But I will say that it is a very dangerous game. I can tell you that I've never signed a game after I've seen that it's had a failed Kickstarter.
And several of Anja's talks are actually on our YouTube page at conferences and sessions that we had on here. The thing that always stood out to me, she said, 85% of your revenue from a Kickstarter is going to come from your existing community. So if you don't already have that, no, don't. And Justin's right. It's like, I don't think it's always fair that, well, I mean, life's not fair, but that publishers will turn down a game just because it failed on Kickstarter, because I have these arguments when we're in green light meetings with publishers and investors. It's the same reason they'll say, well, the first game they did didn't sell very well when they self-published it. It's, well, yes, because they're developers. They don't understand, you know, a lot of times marketing and how to do all this stuff. That's why they need help. But end result is, yes, if you have a failed Kickstarter, your publishers aren't going to take the time to go into the who's and whys and hows, you know, you failed. Well, they're just going to look at it and go, you failed.
So I'm going to say newsflash in case people aren't realizing. I'm actually working on a new talk called Uncomfortable Truths. It's going to be a while before it's done, where I'm going to kind of lay out a bunch of stuff in the industry that you thought you knew but maybe didn't. And one of those is, let me tell you, publishers and investors are chicken. We are absolutely chicken. And so one of the first things we do is look for external validation, both on a studio and on a game. This is why I always tell developers in your pitch, if you've got any awards, if you've got a community, anything that shows you have external validation for that game helps me make a decision. Just to say I'm the lone scout. I get a game in, I'm looking at the game, and I've gotten 20 games this week. One of the biggest things that can help that stand out is they already have a community. I don't care how big it is, but they have a community. They've already won some awards from going to events. They've already, anything that provides external validation that when I bring this to the rest of the team shows I'm not the only one that likes it, right? So there's internal credibility. So it's my credibility when I bring a game to the rest of the team saying, hey, team, let's check this out, right? That internal credibility goes up if it's already got some backing. So even if the rest of the team hates it, I'm like, well, there's a community for it. So obviously there's a, you know, potential audience. So there's internal credibility. Then there's the larger credibility of the fact that now I know I have a community to latch on to. I know there's some people I like the game. I can use that to help target and figure out how to grow the community. So one of the things that publishers aren't good at is starting and developing communities. What they're better at is taking the community you already built and helping you reach more of those people. So if you don't know who your community is and you haven't started building it, it's really hard for a publisher or investor to go, well, gee, I'm going to sign this game and go build their community from scratch. And on the thing you mentioned about, you know, well, their first game maybe didn't sell well, this is why I'm super careful about this. Couple things, right? I would rather sign with a developer that launched a game that maybe didn't sell well than a developer that's never launched a game. And that goes down to the fact that, you know, 80% of the work is the last 20% before you ship. And then as Mike Tyson says, nobody, you know, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. And launching your first game is getting punched in the mouth. And it's much easier to put your faith and trust in somebody who's been punched in the mouth once and knows how to get back up than it is somebody who hasn't. So I'm a lot of times when I see a developer maybe didn't have commercial success, they had some critical success. You know, the community liked the game, the reviews are pretty solid. So I know they know how to make a good game. That solving for sales is a little easier than solving for quality and the ability to ship.
All right, let me answer a quick one before we go on, because it's not something we're going to dive into. So Aurora says, are there publishers that might be less desirable to work with, some that you might want to avoid? Aurora, the short answer is yes, but we're not going to go into it. We're not going to start naming names today. But
do your Google search.
And you will absolutely find out.
Quickly, by the way, this goes into everything. One of the things I try to remind developers of is to do your homework. Right. I think that, you know, just know the publisher and investor are going to do their homework. Right. So you need to do your homework. You need to look at the publisher, the investor, look at the type of games they're publishing or investing in. Look at, you know, look at the developers they've worked with. Look at maybe try to figure out the budgets they've invested in. By the way, look at, reach out to the developers they're working with. Have those conversations. You know, you don't necessarily have to have them before you submit your game, but before you get into serious discussions or talks. You know, it's kind of like showing up at a job interview and not even knowing anything about the company you're interviewing with, right? It's kind of important, and I just say don't be lazy. With Google and all the other things out there, you can get so much information so quick. Spend 10 minutes figuring out, you know, some stuff before you go and look at their Twitter, look at their LinkedIn. I guarantee that's what I do for every developer, right? Once after I review the pitch, before I have a serious conversation with them, one of the first things I do is I look at their LinkedIn, I look at their Twitter. You got to do the same thing. There's just a little bit of due diligence will save you a lot of headaches.
And developers love to share details on why they like or do not like certain publishers. So it's really not hard to find.
Well, then I always take that with a grain of salt though, right? Like I've never met a developer that's 100% in love with their publisher.
There's a difference between being 100% in love with them and then like going on Reddit and having a rant about them. So yes.
That is true as well.
All right, so Jawad from YouTube says, generally speaking, do games with certain release timelines, such as Q1 2024 versus Q1 2026, have better chances for investments?
I think, are we talking about release dates or timelines? So I think, a couple things, right, that you always want a very or as accurate as possible schedule when you're working on your game. Generally, publishers do not want to sign a game, and Jay, you can back me up, if there's not at least 6 months before launch, it's really hard to find a publisher because the publisher needs time to assign a producer, assign PR, assign marketing, build a strategy, build a plan, figure out launch windows. I will say the closer, so within 6 months of launch, it actually sometimes, even though you need less money, sometimes it gets more and more difficult to find a publisher unless your game's already got a bunch of traction. And at that point, you're just needing extra money for PR and marketing and maybe just to finish the game. Then sometimes, yes, again, it goes about size of community. But general, most publishers I talk to want a game that's at least 6 months. The general window is 2 years to 6 months before launch. Sometimes longer. We know dev cycles change. I would urge you, if you're an indie dev and you're spending more than 24 months on dev, I don't know how you're going to stay afloat that long. More power to you. But general, you know, I would say most of the games that I've signed over the last 20 years have been, you know, 12 months to 36 months is the general window. And then it really is about the time, where you are and the time you're presenting it and having an accurate of when it started, where you're at, and when you expect it to be done.
Indie Game Business has one of the longest running digital event series in the gaming industry, with hundreds of publishers, investors, developers, and tech companies to meet with. All the sessions are always free to watch forever, and you can get a free pass to receive all the slide decks from all their speakers. The tickets for meetings start just at $50. Go to indiegame.business and use the code IGBPODCAST to get 20% off your ticket.
All right, so from LinkedIn, Saudi Arabia has made a big commitment to invest billions in gaming over the next 10 years, similar to Dubai's commitment to create a regional technology hub looking to establish 30,000 new jobs. Do you see this new and unique regional commitments can create unique shifts in the gaming sector?
Yes and no. And let me clarify. Yes is anytime a government's going to make that kind of commitment and that long of a commitment. This is where I need to make a very clear distinction. One of the problems with most governments is they make two-year commitments because those people have to be reelected. And so they want to see results in 2 years. And we know to establish any industry, it's a 5 to 10 year thing. And Jay's laughing in the background, I'm sure, because he knows this, because he's talked to a lot of governments about this too. A lot of these politicians I met with come in, they go, have all these grand ideas, they want to support gaming. And then 2 years later, they leave and somebody else comes in and they're not interested, or everything changes and things fall apart. I've seen that in a lot of governments. Now, when you have a government and or the country make a commitment, like I've seen UAE, Dubai, Saudi Arabia in particular, make that changes the game. Because that commitment allows these things to grow, foster, and mature. One of the things I will caution of is that it is hard to create that growth organically. And what I mean by that is I don't know how they're going to get enough talented homegrown people in that short of a time to really build out the ecosystem like that. They were smart in founding Savvy Group. Savvy obviously has made some acquisitions. The trouble is that, you know, by nature, most developers aren't going to relocate. Matter of fact, almost any developer I've been a part of an acquisition or purchase of almost never relocates. Even, you know, when I was at Activision, we purchased studios in LA. They wouldn't relocate to different locations in LA. Imagine how difficult it's going to be. You're going to go buy a 30, 40 person studio in Wisconsin, trying to get those people to move to Saudi Arabia. It's probably not going to happen. So I think what's going to happen first is you're going to have companies like Savvy go buy big publishers or big developers and then start building the talent to support those folks internally and homegrown. I think they're also doing some smart things with the educational cycle and building those out. But one of the things they have to do is launch some small indie publishers. So sure, you have the big ones like Savvy, all that, but they need to get, I guess, strategic about either buying or starting some smaller indie publishers that can focus on helping these student games, some of these smaller things emerge out of the market and grow. Because ultimately, long term, that's the only way you're going to actually build a development hub, unless you can convince a huge company like an Activision or Ubisoft and EA to move a bunch of people there, which again, I don't know how you do it. You know, okay. convincing Ubisoft to move a bunch of people to Canada was not as difficult as trying to convince Ubisoft to put 1,000 people in Dubai or in Saudi Arabia.
All right, so you're dead on, exactly right, because 2 days ago, that's exactly what happened. So they announced one of the French indie studios is moving to Saudi Arabia because you can't just like organically grow this stuff quickly. They are, and so they've paid this studio to pack up everything, moved to Saudi Arabia, and of course the studio is catching flack for it online, but that is the only way they're going to do it, and that is exactly what they're doing. They're paying people enough people to uproot their entire, but that's going to be a very limited number of developers that are willing to do that.
Well, and again, and honestly, it's going to be short-lived too, because those people are going to go over, you know, unless they're not going to suffer from culture shock and everything else, right? And depending on how big it is and how many, you know, I get it if it's a bunch of young single men and women that are doing it. But if anybody's older, has kids, whatever else, you're uprooting everything in the entire studio. It's just tough. I think you can do it for a few small indies. I just question how long those people are actually going to stay in the country before they're just like, they're out. I think you can do that. I think the other thing you can do, and one of the things I'm actually impressed by, is they're spending a lot of time and money building out these educational institutions. You know, I know that one of the divisions of Savvy is very much focused on this. And then, you know, training these people. Now, the trick, though, is, again, how do you keep those people from leaving the country and going to work for somebody in Europe or somebody in the U.S. if they're super talented? You've got to create the opportunities for them within the country, which is why I think the one thing that's missing right now is building out some small to mid-size publishers that can then take these indie games and these studios, nurture them, educate them, and then publish them and establish a global presence that way. I don't think you can just do it purely by acquisition. I think it's got to be a combination. So I would not be surprised to see, in addition to Savvy being this huge conglomerate and publisher, I wouldn't be surprised to see maybe them spinning out some smaller indie-focused publishing houses to then take this homegrown content and try to level it up. And we know it won't be the first set of releases from these companies. It'll be the second, third, or fourth where they might find some success. But my firm belief, and I think Exola's belief, and one of the reasons I love my job here, is that we all believe the next, you know, the big AAA companies of today, the next enterprise companies of today, are the indie, or tomorrow are the indies of today. And I think we've seen that time and time again. And I think that's the only way they're going to be able to sustain the growth over there. Without just overpaying and then having people leave every couple of years.
Yeah, because I mean, it doesn't necessarily do you a lot of good to bring in the young folks. Yes, you'll get warm bodies and they're a little more advanced than the folks that you may have now, but it's the old people like us that have been doing this for so long that you need to have over there. And we're much harder to move, much less keep in one spot. So
I think the other option is to open these studios and then move people over there for periods of time, right? Like I know folks that have gone over for 3 months at a time, you know, and or maybe it's 1 month on, 1 month off for a year or two. I think that's another way to do it. But you've got to have the talent base in there for them to be like, if you're going to go hire, you know, some senior level designer who's been doing this for 20 years and have him come over there and help design a game, he's got to have the talent there that he can work with to help design that game. So it's, yep. It's look, I think here's the thing. When you got that kind of money and you have that commitment, what they talked about, they're aiming for 2030. You're talking about a 7+ year commitment that started a year or two ago, so more like a 10-year commitment. I think you can make it work. I think they've got some really smart people doing some really good stuff. And they've got, again, when you have enough time and money, you can figure almost anything out. So they will make it work. It will change the ecosystem. But let's also be clear, a lot of it has to do with the size of the market. So many people there are now playing games that maybe a decade ago weren't. So the opportunity of the size of the market, just like in other places like Indonesia and Thailand, is also helping grow that market. Because when all of a sudden the ecosystem in that territory is vibrant enough and has enough money coming into it to support it, then you have more developers spin up because they want to go with what they know. And I think that's what will also happen. But it takes a shift.
So from LinkedIn, it seems now we've got such a big gap between fewer big publishers and the other companies. How do you see all this impacting the single A and double A companies?
Well, I think it's always been this way. It's a traditional cycle. I think we saw this, you know, back in the early 2000s, there was this, you know, it was only AAA. And then all of a sudden you had all these, you know, mid-tiers. And then, you know, all of a sudden there was all these acquisitions and you know, especially after the economy tanked in 2008, 2009. And then you saw the rise of these indies and these indie publishers, and some of these became mid-tier, you know, the Raw Furies and the Team 17s and the 505s and all these people spun up and started doing plug-in digital and the list goes on, who, you know, people hadn't even heard of before. And now these are all mid-tier, pretty decent publishers. I think that's cyclical as usual. I think there is a bigger gap, right? You've got these huge AAAs and then you've got the, you know, the small indie. I will say there are more indie and mid-tier publishers now than there ever have been. Obviously, some of those are going to go away. It's impossible for the market to support them all. But I do think that there's plenty of opportunities out there. You just have to find them. But as any creative industry, I was just visiting my cousin in Australia. She's an artist. There's always way more people creating art than there are people willing to buy it and pay for it. Well, especially the people funding the creation of that art. So that's always going to be a disconnect. And one of the great things about the democratization of development and development tools we won't get into the whole Unity and Unreal stuff here. We don't have enough time for that. The democratization is great, but it also means more competition. It's been become way easier to make games. You know, Steam opened up the platform and a lot of people cheered that. I think, you know, it was actually may not have been the best thing for most indie devs, because now you're competing with people just throwing up shovelware and AI created stuff, and you created such a morass of stuff for people to wade through. The competition has just gotten harder. It's not about just building a good game anymore. It's like, you got to build a good game, you have to build a big community, you have to build a marketing strategy, you have to know how to run a business. And for goodness sakes, you have to be able to stay in business for 6 months to a year after you launch, just to see if you might be successful enough to make money. Yeah. And so it's gotten harder. It really has. You know, I saw the launch of Steam, and even the early 2010s, if you put out a good game and managed to even just get a few people to buy it, you could create enough, you know, success around it. Now, I mean, I've seen some great games on Steam that can't sell 1,000 units.
So next one coming in from Western World Studios over on YouTube. Are publishers concerned about indie game devs' access to various AI tools due to potential IP infringement, and to what extent?
This is a freaking great question, by the way. And it's one where I'm going to say this is seller and buyer beware. Most publishers will put into their contracts that you're repping and warranting everything in your game is yours and you own or control the rights to it. So guess what happens? They're going to be careful, but if they get sued, it's going to be on you because you're representing and warranting everything in your game is yours. I think AI is like any other tool. It's going to all depend on who's wielding it and how it's being wielded. I have some friends using it to help them rapidly prototype, find fun, and then they're going to go back and recreate stuff. I just think you got to be super careful. We're seeing all the lawsuits now. ChatGPT's got 1,000 pending lawsuits for stealing other people's content, recreating it. It is the Wild West, and we know that law and government is always 5 to 10 years behind. I think publishers are always going to question what kind of AI you're using and how you're using it in the game. I think it's a fair question, but just know all the liability they can possibly put is going to be put back on you. But again, they won't sign a game if they're worried about being sued. They're still going to put the weight on you, but I'm not going to take the risk. I'll go sign something where I'm not going to worry about being sued. So it becomes super important about how you use it and how clear you are and what you're using.
And that reps and warrants clause is not new. It's been around forever. And the beauty of it is you don't even have to change it for AI. It still says the same thing. Basically, that's what it boils down to. If I get sued over this, you're in trouble.
It's a great question, though, and I think that's it's going to be an unbelievably rapidly changing landscape just because of it's the Wild West, and it's, I mean, my head spins every time I talk to people about it, and it's just going to get worse. But just be as the creator, you know, as the sculptor of a game, just be careful about what mallet and what chisel you're using.
Good analogy. So, Amber on YouTube, how can I make sure that I ask for the right amount of money to not only pay myself to cover bills while working full time, but also pay contractors? Publishers want a list of expected expenses, right?
There's production plans. There's some ones public out there. You should make sure that there's some great examples of how to project schedule and plan and budget. One of the things I remind developers is there's this expression in the investment industry, and I was in this ages ago. It's called pay yourself first, right? And when you're coming to pitch me your project, what I want to see in the budget is I want to see total budget, how much you've spent to date, so I know how much you've already invested, and how much you need to finish the game. But coming into what you need to finish the game is I expect you to be paying yourself a reasonable salary based on your location and experience. I expect you to be paying your team a reasonable salary based on location experience. And if you know you need to have contractors, that should be built into the budget as well. When I talk about running a business, and this is the hardest thing, is I can't trust you with my money if I don't believe you know how to run a business. And if you can't budget properly and schedule properly, which are two of the most important fundamentals of running a business, then I can't give you money. So it becomes super important that you plan this stuff out. There's some very simple spreadsheets you can use. There's all kinds of stuff, but yeah. And I absolutely expect you to be paying yourself a reasonable wage. I do not want to be working with developers that aren't paying themselves, because that makes for miserable, burned out developers, and it makes for bad games. And in particular, because I need to get developers to stick around and stay in business after the game ships, because I need them to maintain the game, update the game, manage the community, all of that. So I want happy developers. Am I going to be willing to overpay you? No, I still need to make money, but I do want my developers motivated and happy and knowing they can go home at night and feed their kids. That's like, that's a bare minimum. So when you tell me you're not paying yourself, that's actually a red flag for me.
So another one from YouTube, for a team that doesn't have prior professional game dev experience, how good does the playable need to be to prove ability to execute with a decent development timeline?
This is a great question. I'm going to tell you, especially things like the more competition you have for fewer dollars, the better the demo's got to be. You've got to figure out who you're competing with and figure out where they're going to probably be pitching their stuff and understand that that's going to be the minimum bar. I'm going to caution a few folks, though. Don't send me a big, huge, fancy 30-minute build if you're a small team and you can't afford to do so. I'd rather have 5 minutes of really solid, demonstrable gameplay of what the minute-to-minute gameplay is going to be like in 5 minutes than a 30-minute mediocre experience. And by the way, if it's gray box and it's fun, that's a pretty good thing as well. I encourage you to find the fun first, then make a build a demo around whatever that moment to moment is, whatever it is I'm going to be doing the most while I play the game. One of the guys over at Sisu Ventures says this, and it's a weird way thing, but it's like, how do I win? What is it that I'm doing most of the time in the game to win the game? And then stepping back is, how good is that? How fun is that? How compelling is that? And how is that different from any other game in the genre? So find those things first. Don't worry about the size and length of the demo initially. But if you haven't shipped anything before, that demo is absolutely everything. I can tell you that if you never shipped something before, I'm never signing a game without a good playable. I just can't. It's kind of like, would you ever buy a car without test driving it? Well, maybe if you test drove the last model, but you're not going to buy it. And the other example I use is, you know, if Elon Musk comes to you and starts a brand new car company, hate him or love him, you're probably going to give him, you're going to probably give him money, right? But if, you know, if I come out of engineering school at MIT or one of the best engineering schools in the world, I've never built a car in my life, and I come to you asking for a bunch of money for this new car that's never been built, you're probably not going to give it to me until I at least give you a test run or show you on a simulation or show you something. It's the same thing. You know, if the folks from, you know, who did the last, you know, when we signed Abzu, right, it was Matt Nava and the folks, a couple of the folks that had done Journey and Flower, and he didn't have a playable. He had a mood video and some graphics on a wall, but this was one of the lead artists and, you know, one of the creators of Journey and Flower. He's basically like, this is, you know, what I wanted to do in Journey, but underwater. Like, and he gave me the visuals and the mood music and everything, but he's instantly credible. So, and you can close your eyes and actually see the game he was making. The farther away you get from that, the more I have to be able to touch and feel and taste it.
I don't think I have ever heard of a mood video.
It was one of the most, obviously, in my career, in the, you know, in person, you know, I've seen probably 6,000-7,000 pitch decks, but in person pitches, well over 1,000, maybe 2,000-3,000. I don't even know. It would be funny if I'd actually had the wherewithal to keep count. It was one of the most amazing pitches in that I walk into the room and on the wall is just this piece of paper, art in colors and like a diagram that kind of went up and down. And then a mood video that was kind of like that and music. And of course, the music was by Austin Wintory. I didn't know it at the time, and he just had a little set piece of music and a mood video, and then he walked you through his vision for the game. But as he's walking you through this vision, you could literally close your eyes, listen to the music, and listen to his voice, and see the exact type of game he was building, and you could understand who the audience was and why they were going to care. And this is, you know, and like I said, I've seen thousands of pitches from some just amazingly talented people. This is one of the most unique, awe-inspiring ways to pitch a game I've ever seen in my life. And I think very few people in the world could pull this off. And of course, Matt Nava, who's just an incredible artist, coupled with somebody like Austin Wintry, is probably one of the best composers we've got in our industry. Not a bad way to start. Not everybody's got that. So you need to figure out how to give yourself a unique advantage over everybody else.
That's interesting. I have heard of these pitches. I've never seen one of them, though.
I will liken this. So Steven Spielberg evidently did something very similar when he pitched Saving Private Ryan to the studios, right? Because he's not going to have a pre-made movie, right? He's not going to have a, oh, here's a demo of the movie, right? So he literally, I guess it was like a really long wall in the studio, and he basically had a graphical roller coaster of the emotional experience he wanted the audience to go through throughout the entire three-hour movie. Right, like the downs, the ups, the, you know, the highs, the lows, and he literally put that on the wall and then kind of read out the story of the movie. And I liken it, it was a little bit like that, I imagine. I would call that my Steven Spielberg moment, but that was with Matt Nava.
So along that same line with how good of a demo that you need to have, but are you aware of publishers that invest at the studio level for equity versus the game level for revenue share?
Okay, so this is a really interesting question. I think it varies. Most publishers aren't usually doing studio equity deals unless that studio's got a track record. You know, again, there was a lot of interesting equity deals that were done in 2020, 21, even early 22, because people wanted to snatch up talent. I will say that if you're looking for equity for your studio, it's a very different pitch than if you're looking for project financing. Make sure that your studio is actually ready to take equity, meaning that all the ownership paperwork is in order, the cap table's in order, all of your legal documentation is in order. It's a much longer process. What I say is that taking project financing or publishing deal is like moving in with somebody. You know, it's interesting. The first year is tough. You probably want to kill each other a few times. If you survive that first year, things might work. If it doesn't work out, you know, you can separate ways. It's still painful and messy. Taking an investment is like getting married. And if that marriage falls apart, the only people to get rich are the lawyers. And you usually end up broke and sad. It is a much more complicated and expensive process. It is more time consuming. And most people that are doing equity investments are looking for hockey stick growth. It's not the current game you're working on. It's what the next 2, 3, 4, 5 games the studio is going to work on beyond just this game, unless you have such a huge hit. So you got to make sure you understand the difference between the two and the strings that come attached with both. Most publishers I know are not building equity deals with the first time they talk to a developer, or the first deal they do with the developer. Sometimes the second deals will do that. You have companies like Tencent, which isn't really doing publishing. They're doing investing, and they'll take minority stakes in exchange for the publishing rights. There are folks out there doing that. There's Kepler Interactive, which used to be why am I blanking on them now? They used to be another investor, Kowloon Knights, who's morphed into now doing some publishing and investing. So they're basically becoming the publishers for all the studios they're investing in. Not all of them, but most of them. So you've seen some hybrids now. Most VCs do equity. Most publishers do project. There's back and forth. There's some both. Make sure, first and foremost, you have a really good game attorney, whether you're looking for project financing or equity. But equity deals are a little different. You got to make sure that you have your ducks in a row very specifically. And even if you're pitching a game to both, it becomes more about the studio than the game. If you're looking for equity, if you're looking for project financing, it's all about the game and then a belief that the studio can deliver the game.
Sorry, I was muted. I was like, we got time for one, maybe two more. So are you around the rest? Are you going to be on Discord if people have questions post show?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to. I can stick around. Let me check my calendar while I got you here and see.
Just like text in between meetings or something like that.
Yeah, no. So
there's some really good questions in here.
No, I love it. So I actually have this blocked out till 10:30 anyway. So I'm open for another half an hour after this, so I can stick around, and then I can pop back and forth throughout the day as well. I'm happy to try to answer any questions I can. I mean, like I said, I'm super lucky. My company pays me to do this kind of stuff. And mine does too. Is it you pay you to do this kind of stuff?
We're not going
to
get into details, Justin. All right. All right. So I want to get to this question because I have been surprised it has not popped up in a podcast yet. Given recent events, will small indie games made in Unity have a harder time getting publishing deals?
Oh, I love this question. I'm actually surprised it hasn't come up already. yes and no. Look, I think now that that runtime thing has gone away.
Has it?
Well, kind of, sort of, maybe. Look, I think anytime you add uncertainty to development, you create difficulties. Development is hard enough as it is. I have a lot of friends over at Unity, by the way, and I'm not going to name names. I actually got to hang out with one of them in Asia, and I had to buy the guy more beers than I care to think about because of just the misery he was suffering from what that poor company did to them and all the heat he's taking. Let's be clear. Making game engines is really effing hard and really expensive. You know, to my understanding, Epic with Unreal is actually not making money on the engine at all. It's the Fortnite business subsidizing the engine. Unity doesn't have a lot of other options. I think a lot of what they're doing is trying to design to force people to use their ad business, because let's not forget they spent, what, $3 billion on Iron Source. I think they all needed to change their business models. I mean, anybody who was looking at the Unity business model for it all in the past know that they had to change that model. Do I think what they've, you know, well, obviously what they initially announced was a whole nother joke, and I don't want to get into that too much because I think we all know what happened there. Do I think where they're at now is the best place for them to be? Probably not. I don't know where they're going to end up. So it does add a level of, I guess, questioning or doubt to it. I would caution that anybody who's making a mobile free-to-play game, period, from an indie studio, you better do a very careful evaluation and look at the top 200. I don't remember the last time a indie mobile game made it into the top 200, even after finding a publisher. So that's an awfully dangerous place to be. I think you got to do the math. This goes back into the business. You need to map out some assumptions. You sell 50,000 units, you sell 100, you sell 500, you sell a million. You should be doing your forecasts anyway. Then you should be figuring out how much that engine is going to cost you. If it's, you know, if it's Unreal and you're not paying for the first million, but then it's 5% of gross, you know, figure out what that's going to look like. You know, if it's Unity, you got to do some rough numbers and figure out how that affects your numbers. So yeah, I can tell you that when that was first announced, I know every publisher I talked to was like, "Oh, way you're going to hold off on all Unity games for a little bit till this settles." I don't think it's discouraging, folks, but it definitely changes the math slightly. So you need to make sure you know the math.
I love the news that came out this week that through some of the backdoor channels, we're starting to see what was going on behind the scenes. And apparently one of the publishers picked up the phone and called Unity and told John directly, "Fuck you, we're not paying."
Yeah. So here's the question I have, and I know this is off topic, so we'll go over time. But like, did they talk to the first parties? Did they talk to Microsoft and Nintendo or Sony about this? Like, well, it's a little bit rhetorical, but I'm like, do you actually think they were going to pay you for this stuff? Yeah. Did you? Because let's be clear, and I without giving away the secret sauce, right? Unreal has a relationship, and I think Unity used to, with all the majors, and so, you know, here's the thing: is if you screw around with Unreal and you owe them money and you don't pay them, they can go to Sony or Microsoft or Nintendo and tell them to stop putting your game up. They can literally have it taken down, right? Unity, if they pulled this move, I don't know if they had the same agreement from Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo. I can actually almost guarantee you they didn't. So I don't know how they were going to enforce this. Especially after the fact. Let's not even get into the legal issues with them trying to do this. It's just
the fact that it became very clear early on from other people inside Unity that they had raised these issues, and the C-suite had just kind of like said it's not going to be an issue. And the fact that even within 48 hours of them coming out, they had already flip-flopped on, well, the publisher is going to have to pay these fees. And then someone else said, oh, no, the platform holders are paying these fees. I'm willing to bet one of these companies that told John that, fuck you, we're not paying, was either Microsoft or Sony.
Well, I can just, I'm going to sit there and like either Microsoft, Nintendo, or somebody just calls them, didn't. And look, I know all the flack John's been getting, and some of it's absolutely deserved. He's not an idiot. there's a lot that happened behind the scenes here that we don't know, and I'm looking forward to hearing some of this come out. And obviously, I know more than I probably should, and a lot that I can't talk about. Let's also understand that he was the scapegoat in this and was forced out. I'm sure that there's a lot. Again, I'm going to go back. I'm going to say one name and one name only. Iron Source. Do your homework on Iron Source and then come back to me.
See, I don't think you get to claim as a scapegoat when you're the CEO of a company that size. Put yourself there.
Okay. Yes. But how about this? He ended up being the sacrificial lamb. Maybe not the scapegoat.
I'll give you that one. All right. So we're at time, but I want to make sure we get you covered here, Justin. Tell us all the cool shit that's coming from Exola and how it's going to help indie devs before we bounce out of here. And then Justin will be around on Discord as well to answer some of these questions we didn't get to.
So first and foremost, I remind everybody that, you know, one of the pleasures I've had over the last 4+ years at Exola is building out something called Exola Funding Club. It was a brainchild of our founder who was, you know, I guess kind enough to, and I had been talking about doing stuff like this, but kind enough to dedicate the money and resources to create a better way for developers, publishers, and investors to find each other. Exola Funding Club, if you don't know, is basically a no-cost digital matchmaking service that allows developers to submit their content for free. We do have a content review process. Not every game makes it on. We are not choosing winners and losers, good investment, bad, but we are saying this game is far enough along to be taken seriously by investors and publishers. The games that get rejected, they're basically told your game's not ready. If you request it, we'll give you detailed information of why it was rejected. And then there's a bunch of resources on the website about, you know, how to craft a pitch, what it takes to pitch, you know, what investors and publishers are looking for. Always encourage people to follow Game Discoverer, Simon Carlos' newsletter, which is fantastic. You know, follow Rami, Ismail, and a whole bunch of other resources. Come back and resubmit. Once the game is approved, we have over 220 publishers and investors on the platform that will review that content really quickly. They'll swipe left or right on it, as they always do, but since there's no cost, no obligation, one is it saves the developer a ton of time and you're not pitching to people who aren't interested. And we have a much better response rate because the publishers and investors know the content's been curated somewhat. On average, 8% of the games that end up on our platform find funding. The industry average is about 0.2%. So it's about 40 times the industry average, the last numbers I have. And again, it's just because it's curated. And so developers, you have to be a little farther along, a little more prepared, but it gives you a much better shot. It's still not the end all be all. You still need to do your homework. You still need to go contact pubs and devs and pubs and investors directly as much as possible. But it's just another tool in the belt. Like I said, I'm super proud of that. I don't know a lot of companies would spend the kind of time and money that our founder has to build this out with no direct revenue goal for it. We don't charge publishers, investors, or developers, nor are those folks required to use Exola. We obviously hope they will use Exola when they're ready. A couple other things we've announced, right? So web shops, which is basically taking people's mobile content, putting it on the web, and allowing them to sell directly to customers. Our founder's vision has always been about direct to consumer, even before anybody was talking about this. You can call it creator community, creators having one-to-one relationships with their followers. We believe that game developers and publishers should have that one-to-one access. So a lot of the stuff we built out is about creating that. Founders packs, you know, early access stuff, creating your own, I don't want to call it Kickstarter, your own organic community campaign on your own website, where you own and control it and you can dictate how those things go. That's a lot of the stuff we've just announced. We're doing an Exola mall. I can't get into a long explanation because we don't have time, but it's another opportunity for developers and publishers to get their games out, potentially reduce acquisition costs, brand awareness. It's just being built out now. It's some really cool stuff going on, and we hope long-term that it will be another distribution hub for developers with a better, easier path towards finding their consumers. And then we're always working on a ton of other stuff. I'm sure I'm going to get yelled at from my marketing team for not mentioning something, but that's enough of the Exola spiel.
but that's what we're here for, to get yelled at by our marketing and our community management teams. It happens to me too. It's all good. Don't worry about it. Thank you so much, man. These are always fun when you come on, and we will absolutely do it again.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. We're out of here. Thanks, Justin. It's awesome. That was a good talk, too. Lots of good questions. So the rundown, sign up for our newsletter, indiegame.business, and you get the newsletter, publisher list, and investor list. You can check out Indie Game Business merch. Streamlabs.com/indiegamebusiness/merch. What's up, Hamster Hammer? Good to see you. And Discord, discord.gg/indiegamebusiness. And like they were talking about, Justin's going to be over there to answer some more questions.
Yeah, just let me know what channel I need to hop into over there, and I'll hop over there after this. I'm happy to try to answer some more questions. I love this stuff. You know that. This is the kind of stuff that gets me excited when I go these ridiculous trade show routes, and I'm just like, oh, why am I doing this to myself? And then I spend all day talking to developers, hanging out, having lunch, you know, just hearing things. It gets me like super jazzed. So,
well, we can actually, do you want to do voice or do you want to do text?
We can do voice for a little while. Like I said, I've got till 10:30, so I got, you know, another 20 minutes that people want to do voice.
Well, we'll wrap up the podcast, but then if you're on the Discord, folks, just stay in the chat room, and I've got to go pick up my son, but Justin will be around and we can do questions and answers right there.
Yeah. So I guess I should leave, click the leave studio here and then just head over to Discord.
That sounds like a plan. Dan?
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Have a great weekend, everybody.
Always a blast, Dan and Jay. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Indie Game Business. You can learn more about the show and our online business networking events at indiegame.business.